From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. When you hear the word terrorism, what comes to mind?
We fail to connect those dots at our broader peril. I mean, there are real active threats and problems out there, and they're not just in any one particular category of this form of violence. And so I think we've really got to have a more realistic and more inclusive sense of when we say terrorism, what we actually mean.
How media coverage of terrorism committed by Muslims differs from other kinds of perpetrators. That's ahead this hour. But first, last week we talked about a new archive of works by the late rapper Tupac Shakur.
I don't know if I should be what they want me to be, or if I should make them hate me so they can stop. You know, like say something mean so they can just stop. But I'm just like caught in the middle of it because, I mean, no one can do that. Police can't do that. They can't stand in front of all those people and control them with a gun and mace and all that. So me with just words, it's like a battle to find the right words to say at the right time.
That's Tupac in his own words. And for the record, the collection belongs to the Atlanta University Center Woodruff Library, which is affiliated with numerous historically black colleges in Georgia. And in the break room on Friday, we got into the debate over whether or not coconut oil is healthy. Yes, we went there. The American Heart Association recently warned it may not be good for you at all. It can cause an increase in LDL cholesterol and is no better or worse than butter or beef fat. Here are your first thoughts. This is Matt Nelson from Athens.
It's kind of funny how the American Heart Association also has their stamp of approval on Cocoa Puffs. I think that eating Cocoa Puffs in excess may lead to some heart problems. I just think it's funny.
We always want to know what you think. You can give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the program. So walking, as you know, everyone knows, is good for your health. Your safety may be another matter. In 2016, 236 pedestrians were killed in Georgia. That's a 40% jump in just 2 years. Sally Phlox is with me. She's president and CEO of PEDS, which advocates for pedestrian safety in Georgia. Sally, good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
I mentioned to you a moment ago, you're my hero. You actually walked here?
I walked here, yes.
How long of a walk is that and how far?
1.2 miles. Takes about 25 minutes.
Is it a pretty safe route, would you say, or are you just used to it and you know where the trouble spots can be?
compared to most parts of the region, it's very safe.
Okay, so Sally, you have to help me understand what's going on here. As I mentioned just a moment ago, 236 walkers killed in 2016, a 40% increase in just 2 years. What's happening here?
Our roads are designed to kill. I would not say this is terrorism. I would say people have moved to roads that were designed for cars only. Part of it is we have affordability problem. People who would rather live in safer areas for walking simply can't afford to. So we've got a lot of people who rely on transit, living in places where there's no safe facilities. I was just out with my coworker on Covington Highway. Looked at 22 bus stops. Is it safe to walk here? What we found is this road has almost no sidewalks, that there's no safe way to cross the street at most of the crossings. There's a lot of places where you can't see what's coming around that corner over the hill. It's just not.
Oh, that's the case in a lot of areas in Georgia, right? Where you can't see what's coming. You can't. There are hills.
That's right.
Sidewalks are bad.
That is correct. And so we documented conditions at each stop and have written down recommendations for each of what needs to be done, which ones are urgent, like right. Where you the overgrown shrubs just block your view.
Well, Sally, look, that's a pretty provocative statement. You mentioned just a moment ago that our roads are designed to kill. Now, look, transportation officials, they didn't set out to design roads that way. So how did we get here?
It's not deliberate.
Right,
I didn't mean
right.
They designed them for that purpose, but that is the design. And a key thing is, will we change it? Now that the demographics have changed and out in the suburban counties, we do have people walking. We do have people relying on public transit, and most public transit trips begin with a walking trip.
That's right.
We need to change those roads. We need to say that saving lives is more important than saving time. This region is so focused on congestion relief that, you know, we don't want to have drivers take an extra minute or two to get to work.
Right.
But when you have 236 people killed walking.
That should get your attention.
Should get your attention and say, hey, ethically, we can't justify keeping our roads designed for speeding.
Yeah, I want to hear from a couple of people that we spoke to. We just simply went out and asked people in Atlanta if you've ever been hit by a car, right? Or had even a close encounter. Here are some of the responses.
Hello, my name is Stephen Spreng. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. Actually, I was hit about 21 years ago while walking in Washington, D.C. by a car that made an illegal right turn on a red that wasn't supposed to happen. I honestly don't drive a car in the city. I'm renting this U-Haul to move bicycles. For 30 years, I've only been getting around by bicycle and MARTA and pedestrian.
How safe, if we're talking about, Sally, the metro areas being difficult for pedestrians, is it any safer if you ride a bike?
It's unsafe for riding a bike in a lot of areas, too. But when you look at the numbers, the number of people killed while walking is at least 10, maybe 100 times as high. Definitely 100 times. If there's 236 people being killed, it's just huge. And I may have that wrong. It may be 10%,
okay.
But it's really an enormous difference. Mm-hmm. So it's very dangerous to ride a bike, too. But when we look at the number being killed, those are huge numbers walking.
So, Sally, we're living in the Atlanta area and in the metro area here. And clearly it's not a pedestrian-friendly city. But I'm wondering, is the state overall, generally speaking, bad for pedestrians?
The state is one of the worst in the country for pedestrians, yes.
Big communities, because the rural areas kind of speak for themselves, right? They're wide open.
Most of the fatalities are happening in large metro areas. About half are happening in the Atlanta region. That is about half the population. We also have a big problem in Macon, in the Savannah area. And in all these areas, it is the more suburban part. If you think about, if you were hit on Peachtree Street, Midtown or downtown, you're probably going to be injured but not killed.
Have you ever been struck by a vehicle?
I haven't.
I have. I actually have. And it wasn't in this country. It was in Egypt. But I've been hit by a car. And there's something that happens when you've had close calls or you've been actually hit. You just develop this fear, right? And walking for me in the city is just something I rarely do. And the big issue for me, and it has to be mentioned time and time again in the work that you do, is speed. The drivers in this area, in major cities in Georgia, they just drive too fast. How do we take that on?
We need to narrow some of our roads. Last week, the Georgia DOT had a road safety audit on Metropolitan Parkway. It's four lanes. The amount of vehicles on that road is pretty low. I think 16,000 a day. You could easily take out a lane, have one in each direction, and a center turn lane. That would cut fatalities. It's what the Federal Highway Administration considers a proven safety countermeasure. You take out a lane, then you have one decent driver who will go the right speed. It will make everybody behind them go slower.
So wait a minute, you're almost talking about congestion being a solution to the problem.
Well, it doesn't mean congestion. A lot of times you can cut the speed without being congested. When you've got 16,000 cars a day, it will work just fine with one lane in each direction because you put in a two-way turn lane. And what slows down traffic is the people waiting to make left turns.
Right.
And that's what causes weaving, too. Another road that's really bad for weaving is Monroe Drive. There's no turn lane. There's two lanes, and people are switching from one lane to the other. So you just make it a lot safer by getting rid of that second lane. Four-lane roads are often the most dangerous kind of road.
And let's hear from one other person that we spoke to about either being hit or having a close encounter in the Atlanta area.
My name is Jaziel Smith. I'm, I guess, originally from here. As a pedestrian, I have almost been hit on a couple of occasions. The driver was speeding in a rush. And if I hadn't been paying attention or if I had, like, been on my phone, I probably would have been hit.
What does PEDS stand for?
Well, the original name was Pedestrians Educating Drivers on Safety, because I just thought the problem was drivers didn't know that we had the right-of-way in crosswalks. And what I learned is that it's really about road design. So we dropped the full name. There's other acronyms taking the place of outdated names like NAACP, AARP. So we don't use our full name.
Yeah.
But I wanted to add something about safety. When I was walking here this morning, when I was passing over the exit from the highway, one driver after another was turning right on red because I had the walk light. And what I did is first I stuck one arm out towards them, and then I did a second arm, both of them towards the driver.
To get them to what? Slow down or to get them to do what?
To get them to stop. Get their attention. Yeah. That basically movement will get their attention. And the first arm didn't get this lady to stop, so I stuck another one out, and then she stopped. And so that's one of the things I recommend to people who walk. Be assertive and get the driver's attention. The stuff about making eye contact doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
You need to be more assertive about that to let the driver know you are taking the road. You don't want to get hit, but you want them to stop. You don't step in front of them till you do get them to stop.
We don't feel that we necessarily have that power. We feel that the driver in that relationship has all of the power, and that we have to be the very, not just defensive, but the very defensive party here.
Well, it depends on where you are. If you're in a place like Midtown, you do have some power. If you're out in a suburban,
I think you're right, yeah.
If you're in a suburban road, you're not going to have the power. They're going too fast to even see what's in the crosswalk.
Yeah. Talk about crosswalks and what needs to happen there. Is there a way to improve crosswalks so that they give better indications to drivers and for pedestrians as to the rules of the road?
Absolutely. A crosswalk by itself on a four-lane road that has a lot of traffic is not safe. It's worse than having nothing, but there are things that improve it. By the MARTA station on 10th Street, they have put in high-tech beacons that flash. You push the button, they have them flashing in both directions. Those work. There's a median island that really helps. And then right near the Midtown Emory Hospital, they've put in a different kind of flashing beacons. These turn red, gets the drivers to stop. That kind of stuff really makes a difference.
And Sally, before I lose you here, give me a couple of communities where you think they've got it right. They're getting it done correctly.
I'd say Decatur is one and Midtown is one. Downtown is improving also. You don't get killed downtown. That is really rare, and it's because the speeds are under control.
Yeah.
It's also, in all these places, there's a lot of people walking, and so drivers expect people walking. Midtown got a lot safer when they put in a lot of residential. When there's a lot more people walking, the drivers drive differently. They look more. Now, out here on 14th Street, they weren't looking. They weren't expecting people walking. You go over to Peachtree Street, and they are. So that's part of what will make it safer is if more people walk. So you said you don't walk in Atlanta.
Yeah,
Get out there, and you'll make it safer.
All right, Sally. All right, I'll take your advice on that. I'll walk a little bit. I'll start today. Sally Phlox is the president and CEO of PEDS. That is a nonprofit which advocates for pedestrian safety in Georgia. Sally, good to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you.
And just ahead, a legendary music producer in Athens has some new music for us. But first, how can media do a better job covering terrorism? This is On Second Thought. Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. Last week, we spoke to Rob Johnson of Gray, Georgia, whose brother Shannon died a year and a half ago in the mass shooting in San Bernardino, California.
After I got over the initial shock, my wife and I were laying in bed and were just kind of praying together, and we both just looked at each other and said, you know he saved somebody. You know he probably went after the shooter. That's just the way Shannon is. He's fiercely protective, and that's just the way Shannon is.
Shannon Johnson saved a co-worker, shielding her from bullets. The shooters were a married couple.
Police say the suspects, 28-year-old Syed Rizwan Farouk and 27-year-old Tashfeen Malik, were shot dead in this black SUV at the end of a massive manhunt. Overnight, a SWAT team sweeping this Redlands home for explosives.
Until we know the motive or we really have a clear something clear, evidentiary based on that motive. I just don't want to weigh in on that right now. We have not ruled out terrorism.
A new research from Georgia State University suggests in incidents like this, attackers' identities have an impact on the coverage. Here to talk more about this is Tony Lemieux. He oversees the Global Studies Institute at Georgia State University. Tony, good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I want to start this conversation. I'm really looking forward to it because there are so many cases that you've taken the time to study and your group has taken the time to study that I've actually worked on and at various stages of this crazy career of mine. But I want to start with comments from the president. You no doubt heard these comments, but I want your reaction to them.
Radical Islamic terrorists are determined to strike our homeland as they did on 9/11, as they did from Boston to Orlando to San Bernardino and all across Europe. You've seen what happened in Paris and Nice. All over Europe, it's happening. It's gotten to a point where it's not even being reported. And in many cases, the very, very dishonest press doesn't want to report it.
So, Tony, you heard those comments from the president. What was your reaction?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that I would, you know, suggest that we clarify. I mean, the first, you know, most obvious one is the claim that things are not being reported. And in fact, our research looks at that very question, what is getting reported? And also just in terms of the actual kinds of incidents, you know, it's one thing to focus on the problem of terrorism writ large, but what we saw there is really a focus on a particular type, you know, particular set of perpetrators, and really at the expense of some of the other kinds of terrorism that we see that are also quite problematic. And so I think that's something we really need to address.
So I want to sort of support what you're saying here. This is from the Washington Post responding to that assertion from the president that the media actually underreports terror attacks. The reporting in the Post goes, the news media do not cover all terrorist attacks the same way. Rather, they give dramatically more coverage to attacks by Muslims, particularly foreign-born Muslims, even though those are far less common than other kinds of terrorist attacks. Does your research at this point support that assertion from the Washington Post?
Certainly in terms of, you know, if a Muslim perpetrator is being focused upon, then yes, you see significantly more coverage. In our analyses, and those led by Dr. Aaron Carnes, who's a postdoctoral research fellow here at the Global Studies Institute, really dug into this. We looked at the cases from the Global Terrorism Database over a 10-year period, and we looked at around 3,500 articles, news coverage of series of events. And what you find is that when there is a Muslim perpetrator, it's significantly more likely to be covered.
Tony, I want to rifle through a couple of bits of sound here and leading up to a question for you. Former Daily Show host Jon Stewart talked about on his show about the murder in 2015 of 9 people at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. They were shot by a white man, Dylan Roof, in Charleston. Here's Jon Stewart, and then another piece of sound I want you to hear.
9 people shot in a church. What about that? That's the part that I cannot, for the life of me, wrap my head around. And you know it. You know that it's going to go down the same path. This is a terrible tragedy. They're already using the nuanced language of lack of effort for this. This is a terrorist attack.
And one more here for you, Tony. Let's talk. This is from the CBS Evening News. This is about a married couple, Amanda and Jared Miller, who went on a bit of a shooting spree. They fatally shot 2 police officers in Las Vegas before the Metro Police Department took them down.
Investigators described Jared and Amanda Miller as anti-government and on a mission to kill police officers. The couple entered this pizzeria around 11:30 yesterday and shot officers Igor Soldo and Alan Beck at point-blank range. The Millers then covered the bodies with a swastika and a Gadsden flag, first used in the American Revolution, emblazoned with the words, "Don't tread on me."
So, Tony, do we know why a violent incident, a mass shooting event, or a mass casualty event of any kind, why some of those incidents get labeled as terrorism and others don't?
Well, and this is really, I think, the crux of our research. You know, first of all, documenting it, you know, showing that there is, in fact, a phenomena there. It goes beyond, you know, looking at a handful of cases anecdotally and saying, oh, yeah, there's a difference here. One of the things that we've done in our research is looked at the actual reportage of various incidents as classified in the Global Terrorism Database. So that's the first piece of it. And there is a difference. There is a difference that's really clearly linked to the identity of the perpetrator. The other thing that some of our research has focused in on is what makes people, you know, a broader public, a broader audience, perceive something as terrorism in the first place. You know, is there something that is really inherent to the identity of the perpetrator, the type of attack, you know, the modality? Does a use of a bomb, for instance, feel more like terrorism than a gun? And what about a lone actor versus a group? Or what about the target? And we've done experiments to really tease out some of those factors as well. So we've got you know, this sort of perspective that hones in on those very core questions. But it really does seem, you know, to have a very significant relationship with the identity of the perpetrator. That's really the thing that seems to be driving what gets considered terrorism in the first place, what gets conceptualized that way. Mm.
So we're talking about new research that looks at media coverage of terror attacks. My guest is Tony Lemieux of the Global Studies Institute at Georgia State University. One more bit of sound I want you to hear. This is from Maniba Salim. She is a social psychologist at the University of Michigan. She did a study in which volunteers were actually randomly assigned to watch video news clips with different portrayals of Muslims. Salim told NPR that after participants watched the negative news clips, they supported all kinds of unconstitutional policies targeting Muslim Americans.
So we saw people supporting policies such as domestic surveillance without the consent of Muslim Americans. We saw individuals supporting perhaps that Muslim Americans should not be allowed to vote, that they should have separate and more thorough airport security lines, that they should be monitored, you know, by the government.
So, Tony, let's take a step back here. What was the question, maybe the set of questions that drove your research project, and what perception or perceptions were you responding to?
Well, I think the initial impetus for the current sort of effort, it really, for me, sprung from the coverage of the Frazier-Glenn Miller attack in Kansas City. That particular event really, to me, highlighted the very stark difference. And one of the things that stood out was he was getting taken away by police. He was in custody, and he was yelling, Heil Hitler.
Yeah.
And
so, Tony,
you know,
why don't we go back and explain that Frazier-Glenn Miller attack?
So Frazier-Glenn Miller shot and murdered people at a Jewish community center, really specific targeting. Now, here's somebody
who ended up not being Jewish.
Right. He ended up, you know, here was somebody who had a long history of activity in the white supremacist movement and Ku Klux Klan, and clearly had this motivational state, as evidenced by, you know, as he was getting taken away, you know, this kind of yelling about Heil Hitler. And initially, you know, I looked at it and I said, why isn't this getting covered, you know, to the extent that it probably ought to be? And I said, you know, I bet it would be really different had he been yelling Allahu Akbar. And it really got... it really bothered me, and I actually wrote a blog about it that very evening, and then said, you know, what we can do is really use this as an impetus to do some research to see what it is about that sort of difference that drives the kind of perception that ultimately would result in people thinking of something as terrorism or not. And it was that event, and it was the differential coverage that really drove it. And then Charleston, so here was the kind of interesting thing, and we're still working on some of this data, but we went and did an experiment that tested those factors I mentioned before, the identity of the perpetrator, the use of a gun versus a bomb, the type of the target, you know, religious institution versus a government building, and a lone versus a group attacker. Mm-hmm. We did that, and we saw, you know, again, this identity of the perpetrator really explain the lion's share of the findings about what would get called terrorism or not. And as you would, you know, hypothesize, if it's perpetrated by a Muslim, participants were much more likely to label it as terrorism and be more confident in that. We then, you know, about 2 months later, the Charleston attack happened, and another instance where it wasn't, you know, initially called terrorism
That's right.
much. And that John Stewart clip that you played before really stood out to me because I said, aha, now we're actually seeing something in the public dialogue to call this what it is, and frankly, what it would be called if the identity of the perpetrator were a little bit different. And so that, you know, prompted us to really quickly develop some additional measures and get back into the field. So now we can look at, did this event in Charleston have any impact over time on how people would label an attack as terrorism or not? And we looked at what kind of coverage they were exposed to. Now, we're still working on the analyses of that. It's a very complex set of data. Yeah. But these things all sort of linked up and got us thinking about, well, now let's look at actual cases. And my biggest concern in all of this, I mean, there's actually several, but one is that if we fail to look at events like Jared and Amanda Miller as terrorism, we label it as a shooter, we kind of explain it away, we then fail to connect the dots. We fail to see things based on the motivational attributes, which is kind of a core piece of the terrorist definition being applied, but also based on what people actually do, the behavioral elements. And it doesn't do us any service to do that. It really causes problems. And I think the other kind of parallel finding that you know, the listeners would like to know about is that, you know, a couple of years ago, there was a study that START did and some colleagues published that looked at what law enforcement is worried about. What do they see as the biggest
threat? Absolutely. Yep.
And one of the things they said was, look, we've got these sovereign citizens and we've got people who are really, you know, they're armed. They're very concerned. They don't think that, you know, police have any legitimacy.
These are anti-government groups.
Yes.
I'm thinking of groups like the Oath Keepers who are anti-government in nature and philosophy.
And ready for, you know, conflict to ensue. And that's one of the things, especially with this, you know, the sort of the sovereign citizens and to some extent the patriot movements and the white supremacist groups as well, where, you know, law enforcement says this is a real problem that we have and a threat, and it's going unrecognized, you know, more broadly, but not by law enforcement to the same extent, you know, to people who say this is what we actually have to worry about and deal with.
Tony, can I ask you before I run out of time here, how do we view terrorism moving forward if it is more accurately covered? I'm thinking back on the New York Post article that the media actually gives dramatically more coverage to attacks by Muslims, particularly foreign-born Muslims, even though those are far less common than other kinds of terrorist attacks. If it were more balanced, the coverage were more balanced, how might that impact our overall impression of terrorism?
So, you know, we don't really know definitively, but I do think that it would either be met with some kind of resistance that, you know, hey, look, that doesn't comport with my
yes.
reality and my expectations. So people may be a little bit less likely to buy into that. And that's one of the things we're actually actively figuring out how to test that. The other thing that it might do is give people a little bit more of a realistic sense. But again, it gets disproportionately covered, and so people, I think, are more concerned with the risk of terrorism and the threat of terrorism, you know, than would be warranted otherwise. If it's labeled as terrorism and, you know, there's a Muslim perpetrator, it's going to stay in that news cycle longer. You're going to see more about, you know, going into the, you know, well, why did they do it, and who were they talking to, and what did they say online, and all of those kinds of things that are part of it. And, you know, again, that's another thing that we're looking into is that sort of differential way that things are run to ground.
Questions that we don't necessarily ask Jared and Amanda Miller or of them or of the shooter at the Colorado Springs Planned Parenthood Center. We don't, generally speaking, ask those same questions of motives about those individuals, or if there is a discussion, it happens and we're moving on.
I think, yeah, that's part of the real big problem here. You know, the question about, well, how did they radicalize? You know, who were they talking to? What were they, you know, those things don't quite, you know, get the same level of scrutiny or attention. And again, we fail to connect those dots at our broader peril. I mean, there are real active threats and problems out there, and they're not just in any one particular category of this form of violence. And so I think we've really got to have a more realistic and more inclusive sense of when we say terrorism, what we actually mean.
Particularly when we know that someone like Dylann Roof was almost exclusively radicalized online.
Well, and you know, in that particular case, there were things that, you know, ultimately came out in the investigation and in the trial, and, you know, this kind of longstanding sentiment, what he wanted the violence to do, in terms of, you know.
Oh, he was very clear about that.
Yeah, yeah. So there's things like that that emerge, and it's like, well, if that's not terrorism, then what is? Because it really is that, you know, violence or threat of violence to affect some kind of social or political change through this sort of intimidation, fear, things that gets people to really look at it in that light. And so by all definitional criteria that we could apply here, short of specifically labeling, you know, based on the identity of a perpetrator, it had all those hallmarks.
Yeah, label it, full stop, move on, let's have the deeper discussion.
I think that's where we really need to get to.
That is Tony Lemieux. He is from the Global Studies Institute at Georgia State University. Enjoyed that, Tony. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
And coming up, Athens music producer David Barbee is back with a brand new album. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. David Barbee is an unmistakable name in the Athens music scene. He runs the famed Chase Park Transduction Recording Studio and has produced albums for Drive-By Truckers, Deer Hunter, New Madrid, and many others. As a performer, Barbee played bass for the band Sugar and made a name with his solo projects. And now he's releasing his third solo album called Tenth of Seas. My colleague Celeste Headley caught up with David Barbee last week.
So you have been such a prolific collaborator in the past, and yet on this album you chose to play all the instruments yourself. Why?
Celeste, I got into recording because I wrote songs when I was a kid. I've always written songs. And I had a four-track, originally a reel-to-reel four-track, and then by the time I was a little older, teenager, a four-track cassette machine that I would play everything on myself, and that was just my way of conveying my songs, which led to me playing in bands, and I had a way to teach people the songs. And it also led to me producing records. It all started with me making these four-track recordings of me playing everything initially in my parents' basement and then just wherever else, band practice space, you know, bedroom, whatever, over the years. And I have always made demos of songs with every band I've ever played with. Did it with Mercyland, did it with Sugar, did it with the Quick Hooks. And on this most recent batch of songs, I would teach various people the songs, and it would be better in some ways, but it would lose something in others. And so I kept going back to these demos and realized that there was some odd thing about it that I kind of liked. And I also really liked the immediacy of it, the conveyance of emotion of recording something in some cases moments after the idea hits you and trying to get it as close to the source of inspiration as possible. I played demos of songs for a couple of friends who I play music with, a couple of the Quick Hooks guys, Frank McDonald and John Mills, and they had both had asked, well, who's playing the drums on that? And I said, well, I am. And Frank said, you should just record it like that. And I started thinking about it and realized, I think I'm just going to do it. So one thing led to the other, and so I just kind of made this record of me as close to the point of inspiration as I could get it.
Although you ended up with a lot more than four tracks, it sounds like.
This is not done on the four-track cassette. I did this on analog tape, though, which is a very important distinction, not to be an analog purist or a snob or anything. But I did it because it's not as easy to fix things on analog tape as it is on a computer. The amazing powers of Pro Tools or any digital audio workstation, and they are amazing, provide us great creative pathways, but also a lot of creative crutches where you can make things that aren't in tune in tune. You can make things that aren't in time in time. You can fix things, but you can also like rub the feel and rub human emotion out of things. So by doing it all on tape, I really couldn't use my years of studio wizardry to fix things. I basically, and especially with me running back and forth in the studio to the control room, I pretty much had to play everything on there is pretty much an end-to-end performance. As for the four track, no, it is on 2-inch 16 track, which is my favorite of all the analog tape formats. And but on some of the songs on the album, there really are only like 6 or 7 takes. Like I will use like 2 or 3 mics on the drums. And it's there's some songs where the vocal and the guitar is just one mic in front of me. And I've just kind of got to, again, like I was a kid, I've just kind of got to either play the guitar harder or sing a little louder or you know, just basically make a human adjustment for, as a mix adjustment.
Well, let's actually hear some music here. This is the first single from the album. It's called Portuguese Door. So this way that you have recorded the album, how does that then affect a live performance?
I've always looked at live performances and records as two different expressive mediums. So for the live performances, what I'm doing, I'm not a one-man band. I'm not
right.
playing everything myself live like Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins. I have enlisted my friends New Madrid, with whom I have produced 4 albums so far. The way all this came together, I'm kind of jumping around here a little bit, but the way this came together is I was playing with their drummer one night when I was in the middle of working on this and showing him the new songs. And Alex Woolley said, "These songs are great. I love playing this. I think the other guys would be into doing this too." And it took about 5 minutes, and I formulated this idea of what if we did a tour where you guys are my band and we open for New Madrid? Or in some cities, it wound up where New Madrid opened for David Barbie and Inward Dream Up. And he said, "I love it. I think they would too." We talked about it the next day. And within about 3 days, I'd worked out my record deal with Orange Twin and talked to their agent, Jesse Rossoff with United Talent in New York, about booking the tour. And there we go. And about 2 weeks later, I had a finished record and went to New York and mastered it because I had to get it done if we're actually going to do this tour this summer. So live, yeah, it is me backed by New Madrid. And those guys really know the songs. We just got back from a 2-week run up to New York and back. And they've really got the feel of this down. And there's some things, some of Ben Hackett's bass lines are note for note what I did, but kind of his own take on it, just, you know, as far as the feel goes. But it's as close as I would want it to be. But it kind of having different people play it makes it kind of a new game every night, which is cool for me.
Let's hear another song. The album's called Comet of the Season. This song is called You're Out. Blast away all the cynicism. That song is from your album called Comet of the Season, and it's called You're Out. So one of the things that you do, and actually that's not just on this song, but the playing sometimes with rhythm and getting both playful with it. I wonder when you're writing tunes, how much you innovate and go for surprise and how much you go for a hook.
That's a great question. I try and I pretty much follow my muse 100% of the time when it comes to songwriting.
You don't strategize it.
No, I'm. There are songwriters that I've worked with, amazing songwriters who are true craftsmen. That is, they're methodical. They have a pattern in which they write things. It's thought out. This time signature goes here, et cetera, et cetera. And then I've worked with other people who are complete fits of inspiration. And I pretty much fall into the latter category and have for a long time. When I was younger, I wrote songs in a more standard way where I was aware of verse, chorus, time signature, et cetera. But over time, I get an idea for a song. I don't think I'm hardly the only person that does it this way, where it's almost like I just hear it in my head. Sometimes it's like a complete thing. And I try and get it out either on a piece of paper or onto some sort of recording, whether that could be like in my phone. Again, as close to this point of inspiration as I can, and I do a lot better. I get results that are more satisfying to me when I am more feeling and less thinking. So I try and follow the muse and stay in the fits of inspiration as much as possible.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Athens musician and producer David Barbee. His new album is called 10th of Seas. So I wonder, you know, because look, it takes a unique person to be successful as both a solo musician and someone who plays in bands and is a producer. That requires someone who can really work well with very different personalities. And I wonder what you learned from your parents about that. Having to work with big bands would also require you to play well with the team.
My parents were big band musicians. My mom was a singer and an actress. My dad played baritone, sax, and clarinet. It was a composer and musical arranger, and was also the tour manager at times of his career for the bands he was playing in. It's not like it was today where there's an independent tour manager. It was just one of the band members typically was just, you'll make a couple of extra bucks, but somebody's got to arrange the hotels and the itineraries, etc. So, working with all these different people in all these different ways does absolutely require an ability to work with all kinds of people. And for me, I think that comes pretty easily because I like all kinds of people. I find the differences in people to be fascinating and to be rewarding. And if we were all the same kind of music, the same personalities, even in terms of things that can be troublesome in some ways, just like a more mercurial personality is interesting. You know, it takes all kinds, variety is the spice of life. As far as my parents go, I did learn probably quite a bit just sitting around the dinner table every night, because as most nights, my parents were coming home from a studio or maybe a musicians' union board meeting, or it could have been a concert somewhere. My mom could have had a voiceover gig or something. So my life was filled with creative personalities, stories about those people and just what went on during the day. And, you know, the best advice I ever got from anybody was from my dad, who had told me as a young man to never give myself anything to fall back on, because you'd fall back on it, and that instead I should just do what I loved in life, and if that didn't work out, I'd have to figure out something else. So I have pursued that, and so when that is working in the studio, that's what I'm doing, and if it is working with students at UGA, that's what I'm doing, and if it is traveling around the country in a van and playing music with a band, that's what I'm doing. And if it's writing songs, that's certainly what I'm doing. Is that I'm pretty open to change. I'm pretty open to learning. Try to be, at least. Hope so. And am pretty flexible.
So let's actually hear a little bit from the band Sugar. This song is called If I Can't Change Your Mind. know when you're writing a song whether it's best best used on a solo album or on an album with a band, or maybe best played by someone else?
I usually have a pretty good feel when I'm writing songs where I think it goes. For me, most of my career, my own musical output has been either I am in a band, I am working solo. But the 90s, the Sugar Days, definitely was an era of three distinct possibilities of output for me. One was songs that would wind up on Sugar Records. Two would be songs that I might play with Buzz Hungry, who was an Athens band I was playing with at the time. And third would be other people covering my songs. At one point, I had songs on a recently released Sugar album, songs on a Buzz Hungry album, and a song on a Katie Lang album all happened right at the same time, which was pretty cool. As far as KD goes, there was a version of that song on Comet of the Season and on her album, Drag. And sometimes somebody else doing the song, it's something I have never pursued. It's usually something where somebody's come to me. In the case of Katie Lang, Eddie Gomez, that what used to be known as Bug Music, it's now part of BMG Chrysalis, approached me and said she's got a new album, she's looking for songs, and I think that she's looking for something like this, and I think that you could write it and would be perfect. And it was the weirdest thing where I told him, it's like, man, I have like two lines I wrote about two nights ago that I think are exactly what you're talking about. Let me see if I can finish this thing up and send it your way and see what we got. And I did, and he liked it, and she dug it and put it on a record, and there you go.
And what song was that?
It was on her album. It is known as Your Smokescreen. On Comet of the Season, it's known as Medicine Takeover, but it's the same song.
So this, with this new solo album and touring it live, is this a one-off? I mean, where are you going to – do you feel like this is a style for you in terms of doing solo albums where you record everything yourself and then it changes however it might change when someone else plays it live?
So far, so good. I mean, quite possibly. I see two avenues for my own songwriting for the next couple of years. One is that, yeah, I really did love the experience of doing this. I loved capturing the immediacy of it. There's none of it I listen to that I regret. I favor things that, again, are like, and it's funny, in life, of course, I'm a chronic overthinker, just like a lot of people are. But when it comes to making music, I do greatly value the moment of inspiration. But doing the last 2 weeks of shows with New Madrid, now I'm considering the idea, I'm mulling over how can we make a record together in this configuration. So I'm just hoping to continue moving forwards. Forwards is always the more interesting direction for me rather than looking back. So hopefully I'll just keep on moving forwards and changing. And as far as making another record like this goes, quite likely, because I enjoyed it and I'm so far pretty happy with the results.
David Barbee, his album is called 10th of Seas. David, thank you so much.
Celeste, thanks for having me.
David Barbee will perform at the 41 in Athens this Friday at 9 p.m. and also at 529 in Atlanta this Saturday at 9. And that's our show for today. But we always love to hear your comments. You can reach us, call us, leave us a message at 404-500-9457. Or you can post to Twitter. We're at OST Talk. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPP News. I'm Tony Harris. Have a great day.